From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The music we're hearing is called 100,000 Billion Pieces for Piano and Computer. It was composed in part by a man named John Supko. I say in part because the piano portion of this work is being improvised by a person in response to sounds generated by a computer. That person is named Conrad Tau, and he is our first guest today. Born in 1994 in Urbana, Illinois, Tau was a prodigy. It is said he started playing piano by ear when he was just 18 months old. His first recital was at age 4, he was performing with orchestras a few years after that, and had performances of music he composed himself featured on national public radio broadcasts starting at age 10. Here he is on NPR's Performance Today from the Aspen Music Festival.
Would you please welcome to the stage here at Harris Hall, Pong Pong Gong and Conrad Tau.
He and another young composer, pianist, had made an arrangement of Happy Birthday for the festival's music director. As I said, Tau was born in Urbana, but before long his family moved with him first to the Chicago suburbs and then at age 9 to New York. And that's where he's based today. But Tau is set to return to Illinois this week to open the new season of the Nova Linnea Musica series. It's a solo concert of contemporary classical music, 6:30 Wednesday evening at Guarneri Hall in downtown Chicago. I spoke with Tau last week. Conrad Tau, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Let's start with the title of Wednesday's concert, Echoes and Algorithms. What does that phrase mean to you?
I didn't come up with this title myself, but I don't remember that I did, but it feels really apt. When I was putting this program together, I was thinking about, well, I guess I had a piece as a starting point. I wanted to bring a piece that I commissioned almost a decade ago now, but also it's a piece that is sometimes a little hard to describe and it's a little hard to program, especially since I so often am working in very traditional concert hall settings. It's a piece by John Supko called 100,000 Billion Pieces for Piano and Computer. And it's a piece that is basically like a relationship. Like what is given to me by John is a computer program, a piece of software that is able to draw from an enormous bank of sounds that I can also personally add to, but it's a computer improviser that I am playing with. And it's a completely modular work. It can be as long or as short as one wants. And my part as a pianist is entirely improvised. And there's so much in that piece that I really love, but I guess I've been fascinated for a long time by just work in which you are playing with electronics, especially with computers, but also where the electronics are somehow responding actively to what I'm doing. And there's a long history of this in concert music. There's a long history of like electroacoustic music and electroacoustic music with live electronics, responsive electronics. But I think what I love is pieces where the electronics are not simply like responding to an audio signal from me and then, you know, triggering something happening, like where that kind of signal flow is one directional coming from me, where I am always the activator. I think I get very excited by things that are a little bit more, I guess, of a two-way street, maybe more than two ways if you want, where there's something about the construction of the work that requires me to also be listening to the computer. I like that kind of a frame. So I wanted to explore, I wanted to create a program that sort of orbited some of those ideas in a way.
How much do you have to understand about how a program like that actually works before you can perform with it?
I think that's a great question, actually. I like to understand a bit, just because I like technology and I find I've grown up using computers. And so in some ways that kind of thinking is really intuitive to me. I also really like understanding how things work because I'm kind of a theory first learner myself. So I think I like having a sort of theoretical grounding before I like pay attention to the sort of manifestation or the surface of something. But I also try to keep what I know or what I learn about at a, I guess, both a very fundamental level, but almost fundamental at a poetic level. So I think it's more important to me to understand what the composer's thinking process is in how they designed the software than necessarily me knowing the nuts and bolts of the tools themselves, you know, whatever little proprietary tools a composer might be using to execute the vision. I think what's more important to me is like, what are the fundamental relationships? Like what's the dramaturgy of the software? What are the relationships that we're setting up? What are the musical relationships in the piece? That's, I think, what is most important.
How much do you know going into performing 100,000 billion pieces for piano and computer every time, right? Is it, I mean, do you know if it, and I don't know if I'm anthropomorphizing it or how you think of it, but is it going to start with a chainsaw or, you know, a sample of a bass clarinet or, you know, key of G? How do you what do you know going in?
I actually know very little. What I do know is the general set of behaviors and sound worlds, because I've spent time with the work, and so I've explored already different possibilities. And I should add that even though the work is in a lot of ways a software with its own autonomy, it's also an instrument for me to play. I can use, and I will be using, like a wireless keyboard, and I'll be playing it from the piano, like I'll just be triggering different commands. I can switch between modes. And actually, in this way too, these are compositional choices. It's really interesting in a work like this where the composition is not necessarily like a fixed sequence in time. What the compositional parameters then are probably better described as like relationships and possibility spaces. And so I try to be familiar with like what is possible on my end, like what kinds of behaviors can I switch between. But John has deliberately designed the software also that I cannot progress through the piece completely of my own volition. There are ways in which the piece can only progress. I can only move on to a new piece, let's say, when the computer allows me to. So there's a sort of back and forth. And again, that's what I'm attracted to. I there's something almost unsettling to me about it being like me playing God.
There's so much talk these days about people developing relationships, right, with these large language models that we're calling artificial intelligence now, these math language prediction machines. I wonder, do you ever get the sense that there's like some form of intelligence that you're performing with, or is it always a machine? It's always an instrument.
I'm so happy that you brought this topic up because I commissioned this piece from John in 2016. And at that point, John was already working quite a lot on like machine learning technology as both a sort of technical tool for executing his work, but also as a sort of way of opening up musical and conceptual questions. I don't know. I almost feel like the conversation about like whether or not it's a true intelligence is almost like not the relevant question, or not the one that's so interesting to me. I think that at the end of the day,
I'm interested in how it feels to you.
Whether
it is or not, do you perceive it that way ever? Do you find yourself slipping in the moment? I don't know.
I don't know if I would characterize it as Intelligence, but it is certainly making choices, right? The computer is capable of listening to me, and then there are behaviors that are coded within it that the computer can choose between. And this is an area where I actually don't know all of the nuts and bolts of what's going on. I know the computer can listen and identify notes that I'm playing, but I don't always know if it's like trying to mimic what I'm doing or if it's working against. In fact, from my observation and from John's sort of stated design philosophy, it's both. And so, in a lot of ways, that has more to do, in my mind, with principles of group improvisation. There's a guitarist named Joe Morris who teaches at New England Conservatory, and he wrote a wonderful book called Perpetual Frontier, which is sort of about. The subtitle is The Properties of Free Music, and it was his attempt at constructing some sort of framework for thinking about free improvisation, and he calls it a meta methodology, a methodology for creating a methodology. And one of the loveliest ideas that he presents is in group improvisation, the idea of postures of interaction. So think I'm getting it right. It's you can be in unison, you can be complementing one another, you can be in juxtaposition with one another, where you are deliberately kind of positioning yourselves against one another. And of course, you can be silent, which is probably the least appreciated mode. And so when I'm thinking about John's piece, that's what it feels like. I'm sort of trying to intuit and feel out how the computer is relating to me. So that's really just listening, because the computer is capable of sometimes having a very one-to-one relationship with my input. And then, of course, maybe the most important thing is John designed the electronics, in his words, to be provocatively incomplete. So it is incredibly important that I bring choices to the table. So I am also trying to make choices that are hopefully good musical choices. And then, there is the element of the computer which is outside of my control that I then have to interact with. I don't really know if that's intelligence. I don't feel like I anthropomorphize it, because actually I think I'm kind of orthodox about this. Like, tools are tools. I've never even been a big fan of personifying my instruments, which some people like to do. So I think of it more
Lucille, the
like,
guitar. Yeah, you don't name
yeah,
the
right,
piano.
exactly. And I mean, I don't know. I have a lot of issues with that personally. But in this case, I think it's I think of it more as John's trace. It's like his trace is what does he allow the software to do? But of course, his trace, I mean, John's vision is also about indeterminacy and is about sort of what gets opened up when you have software, creating meaning. Basically, I guess that's it. Like, what is the meaning that can emerge in this kind of mystery?
You're premiering a new piece by Chris Mercer that Nova Linnea Musica commissioned. What can you tell us about that?
So this is a brand new work by Chris, who I discovered via his work with live electronics. And so when it came time to figure out what to do for this program, that the idea of getting something from him really excited me. So he wrote me this piece called Impromptu Fluorescing, and it's a really just bubbly, happy piece. I hope he wouldn't be offended by my characterizing it that way. And it's a piece, again, in which the computer electronics are both sometimes are responding to me and other times are behaving in such a way that I have to listen to what they're doing to make my musical choices. There's most of it is through composed, but there are elements of improvisation within it, again, where I basically have to make decisions. And I would say that, like, the piece, to get technical about it, he's using a scale, a non-octave scale that he created, sort of stacking the mode Lydian on top of itself, which creates a lovely bright harmonic texture. And then beyond that, I feel like the piece is so, I think I already used the word bubbly. There's something so playful about it and active about it. Sometimes I'll just let the electronics go and talk to themselves, and it's so enjoyable to listen to. Some of it actually makes me think of leveling up in an old video game, even though that's not really the content of the work. So it's a lovely, short, and charming piece.
Okay, before we take a break, let me reintroduce our conversation. We're speaking with the Urbana-born pianist and composer, Conrad Tau. He's performing a solo concert of contemporary classical music in Chicago this Wednesday evening at Guarneri Hall. The program includes this piece called Tell Me Again by Ben Nabuto. We'll have more of our conversation with Tau when we return. This is The 21st Show.
Support for The 21st Show comes from listeners like you and the Des Moines Art Center, presenting Firlet Baez, featuring colorful, large-scale works engaging history and legacy, on view through September 21st. Details at DesMoinesArtCenter.org.
It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with the Urbana-born composer and musician Conrad Tau. He's performing a solo concert of contemporary piano music this Wednesday evening at Guarneri Hall in Chicago. This performance we're hearing now is a duet, Rhapsody in Blue, with Tau on piano, along with the tap dancer, Caleb Teicher. This was for an NPR Tiny Desk concert back in 2023. This piece is not on the program this week, but I'm including it to give you a sense of Tau's range. Tau and I spoke last week. Because of that, we're not taking calls live today, but you can always share your thoughts by email. The address, talk@21stshow.org. You're also performing one of your own compositions, Hot Air. The notes that I've seen describe it as a musical conversation that explores new and old traditions. What traditions are you putting in conversation?
Those may not be my notes. So Hot Air is something I developed during the sort of first months of COVID lockdown. I was in my apartment and just, you know, making music on my own. I pretty immediately dived into trying to make work, and I actually have to say I kind of enjoyed the fact that COVID lockdown took away all these external circumstances for making work, which meant that I was making work purely for myself. But I was really missing playing music with others, and so I wanted to create something that would allow me to make music with my room. That was how I was thinking of it. I wanted to activate my room, and I wanted to do so in such a way that, again, I would actually have musical activity or sonic activity, behavioral activity in the electronics that I would be able to respond to and engage with as a musical partner. So what that means in practice is that I basically set up a situation where the electronics are completely like live processed sound. I have my microphones, you know, taking in my piano input, and then I have it. I have some tools that are live reversing the sound, creating grains of variable sizes where the sound gets reversed. I then am throttling that through a really aggressive compressor, so that it produces a lot of feedback. And then I am throttling that with the opposite, a sort of reversed noise gate. So when the computer's sound, when all of that live feedback reversed sound goes above a certain volume level, the sound stops. So what this then ends up doing is it makes, first of all, it kind of controls the situation. It controls the feedback from actually getting out of control. But But it also produces these incidental rhythms where the sound is sort of like, I'm struggling to find the words, but I was going to say bottoming out, but it's almost the opposite of that. So hot air, literally, like the air is hyperactivated and very sensitive. That's basically what's happening. And then I found that quite lovely.
Entropy, right? The entropy of the air.
Yes.
I think listening to you talk about this, people might not, if they're not familiar with your work otherwise, they might not know that you also play Gershwin and Rachmaninoff and Bernstein.
I sure do.
What draws you to these newer technologies?
You know, first of all, it's just a part of my life. I started playing piano at a really young age, and I also started working in the field at a very young age. So I grew up in a pretty traditional classical music education, and when I started my career, it was, you know, from day one in traditional classical concert spaces. And one thing I'm very grateful for is that I was also a composer from a young age, and so I had mentors in that space. I had composition teachers who gave me recordings and showed me scores, and so I do feel very lucky that my frame of reference was expanded from a very young age. When I was 10 years old, I started listening to Steve Reich and John Adams scores, and so I did get a signal early on that there was more out there. And then as I got older, the internet was a really important part of my creative development. And I discovered the worlds of a sort of online DIY culture at the sort of tail end of the 2000s, which was a really fertile time for blogs. And I just remembered these MP3 blogs that would just be so beautifully, chaotically designed, and it would just be full of SoundCloud embeds. And it was just like people making music on GarageBand, like kind of like weird lo-fi digital music at home, and uploading it under all these crazy pseudonyms. So there was also these layers of anonymity as expression. And it really just showed me that there was so much out there. And also the internet was a way for me to find other people who were also like voracious listeners and I guess a little weirdo art freak somewhere in there, you know? I think that, so some of it is actually very sentimental. Some of it is about like honoring that history and remembering where I came from. And it's funny that like in some ways it's like that's what I feel is a very authentic version of remembering where I came from, not only, you know, my childhood music education, but also I feel this urge to emphasize that it's not just about technology either. I think it's about relationships. It's about listening. I mean, in some ways, I feel like the questions are still very traditionally musical. And actually, in a way, when I look at this program, I feel like one of the only pieces that's maybe more explicitly about the internet and technology is Ben Nobuto's piece, which is actually just a piece for piano, and it's an outdated term, but piano and tape, piano and like just a track, and the track sounds so good. I mean, Ben is such a great just producer, but there's all these like kind of YouTube snippets, like ASMR snippets, or like a vlogger doing a story time, meditation clips and stuff. And I think Ben's piece is more explicitly about the struggle to find focus in a very highly stimulated world. And Ben is also a little bit younger than me too. So I feel like it's very much an expression of his experience. But for the most part, I feel like all of this work is more about relationships and listening. And in that sense, it's not that different from what I think are the core values of music making.
His piece is called Tell Me Again. Yeah. How do you think about, I mean, you in addition to being a performer, you're also a composer. How do you think about pushing classical music forward, right? That old tradition versus innovation conversation.
I lately almost don't think of it as pushing the form forward. I think of it more as like having the form feel like an honest reflection of the context in which it's in. And the time that it's in.
So not a European court in the 1700s, necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is, I think this does kind of go in multiple directions. Like, I think that there are good questions that you can raise about whether it's, quote-unquote, correct or makes sense to bring, say, this program to Symphony Hall. Because I think, you know, there is a important question to ask about, like, what is the context here? But I think, first of all, I don't even want to just think macro about this, because a lot of this is simply just me being greedy and wanting to just do things that I like. So a lot of my motivation is very selfish in that way. But I think the thing that I feel most of a tension with that I sometimes encounter in the classical music space is anxiety. I was gonna say pushback, but it's really more like anxiety. Anxiety that that if you don't signal that you know what the correct thing to do is, that you have nothing, that you're gonna lose everything. I think that audience etiquette is an interesting example of this, where I have a feeling that a lot of audience members do experience a lot of anxiety, first timers and regulars alike, about like, what response am I supposed to be having? In fact, I remember I have one touring recital program that I do with a tap dancer, Caleb Teicher, and the program is called Counterpoint. And we made it in the summer of 2020 as a video, and it debuted as a video. And
there's an NPR Tiny Desk concert of this, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There is an NPR Tiny Desk that excerpts parts of that program. So this debuted as a video presented by the Library of Congress in 2020, and it premiered, and it was, this was the day, these were experimental COVID concert presentations. So they had us in the chat as the video was premiering, which I always found kind of funny, because I was like, I'm supposed to be on stage. But what was interesting about that was seeing people's responses. And early on in that program, there's an improvisation. And I'll never forget, one audience member typed, I'm not sure I have the tools to evaluate this improvisation. And I thought that was so interesting and so illustrative. And I was considering whether or not I wanted to type anything in response. And then another audience member responded and simply said, well, how does it make you feel, with a smiley face? And I thought that that little exchange there encapsulated so much about some of the complicated energies that sometimes float around a classical concert space. I think that I was very grateful to that audience member for actually articulating that. I think that that's a hard thing to say. But I also feel like it's indicative of me, I would say, kind of the wrong questions that sometimes people might ask. And I think it reflects maybe an anxiety that probably has a lot of different sources, but this anxiety that you're supposed to have the right response, or you need to have a specific set of experiences and contexts to have any response at all. This is not to deny the value of having information and context, but not at the expense of you completely not trusting yourself, right? To have any sort of response at all. This is something that's shaped by my own family experience. My mother is not a musician. She kind of eventually learned to turn pages, I think, just by looking at the density of a score, but she never actually read music. She doesn't speak the vocabulary, but she did grow up listening to me practice and going to my lessons when I was a kid. And she developed a pretty good ear. And I still, to this day, really like playing for her, because her point of view is really valuable to me. she isn't a musician. She can't talk in technical terms. So she talks in much more human terms. She talks about whether or not she can hear me in the music. She talks about whether or not it sounds like I'm playing and I'm expecting what's going to happen, as opposed to like letting the music feel spontaneous, you know? And ultimately, these are the real core, this is the substance of music. All the other stuff is the surface manifestation, but the substance of music is the relationships between objects.
We're coming to the end of our time together. I mentioned in the introduction that you grew up in Urbana and then the suburbs of Chicago, but by the end of your first decade of life, you were in New York City. You're coming back to perform in Chicago for this concert. I wonder, how is the context of performance in Chicago, creating music in Chicago, is it different than in New York or Europe or California or other places you've performed?
I don't know. I can't speak to more broad differences necessarily. For me, I am so happy to be from the Chicago area, to be from Illinois, to have a little bit of Midwestern in me. And I'm really grateful that Chicago was like my first music town, because I had a subscription to the CSO when I was 5. I grew up going to Ravinia. I also studied in Chicago. I mean, that I feel so fortunate, because the wonderful thing about the Chicago music scene was that you had such amazing musicians all around, but also you had like a more intimate small town feeling. And that is very different from New York. I mean, New York, for better or worse, is a much more professionally minded place. And I, for example, left the Music Institute of Chicago in Winnetka and went to Juilliard's pre-college division, which felt by comparison like a much more pre-professional type environment, where on some level, everyone shared a little bit of an ambition to do this for their, you know, livelihood in some form, right? Chicago did not feel like it automatically carried that pressure. And I, looking back, I feel very fortunate about that. And then as I got older, I actually grew to appreciate all these other things about Chicago's musical context, the sort of like history of Chicago blues, the amazing history of Chicago dance music, electronic music, the sort of legacy of house, and more in more contemporary context, the sort of legacy of footwork. All of the amazing dance culture in Chicago, and there's a really, you know, great new music community here too. In New York, I met plenty of people with histories with the Dal Niente Ensemble, and people, you know, who worked at the schools here. So I feel very connected to Chicago, and I also just always feel warm inside when I get to play back at home.
Well, Conrad Tau, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us on the 21st show.
Thank you.
Conrad Tau opens Nova Linnea Musica's new season, 6:30 p.m. this Wednesday at Guarneri Hall in Chicago. This is the 21st show.